Welcome to another episode of the Peak Performance Selling Podcast, where we interview top sellers and sales leaders to learn the different tips, tricks, and mental strategies that they use to create sustainable peak performance. Let's get rolling. Welcome to this week's episode of the Peak Performance Selling Podcast. Super exciting guest that I met recently as part of this ELS group that I'm a part of. And it's Jeff Kirchick, who's VP of Sales at Colossus and author of the award-winning book, Authentic Selling, How to Use the Principles of Sales in Everyday Life. A lot of you that listen frequently know I love talking about, you know, how do we get better at sales and get better at life? And there's such good alignment around how do we actually show up authentically? And so I'm super excited to learn from Jeff, because not only has this book won several awards, the 2021 Independent Press Award, which is pretty powerful, but he has a depth and knowledge of helping scale and grow companies and sales teams. He led the Y Combinator-backed Nextcaller as the VP of Enterprise Sales to a successful exit in March of 2021. And beyond being a sales leader and author, he speaks, he drives courses online, he does advising for early stage tech companies, investor, helps companies think about how do they grow their sales organizations. So this guy is a wealth of knowledge. He's seen companies grow. He's seen the path that most any of us in tech sales want to see our company get to if we're in that earlier stage of that illustrious exit. And he's just got this really interesting way that he showed up when we were in a group together that I think is going to bring a lot of value to the team here as we all get a chance to listen and learn. So Jeff, thank you so much for joining on today.
Yeah, thanks, Jordan. It's going to be a lot of fun to chat with you today. I appreciate it.
I love you taking the time out to help companies, help other sellers think about how can they grow, other leaders, how can they really move forward in their careers. And so I'd love to hear, you know, maybe somewhere along your career path, what's been something that really impacted why you think authenticity needs to show up in sales more?
Yeah. So I've had an interesting path in my career, which is that I've always been fortunate to kind of fall into situations where I was granted an opportunity to do maybe to perform a role that maybe I wasn't yet qualified for. And that might sound nerve-wracking on paper, but in a way it's a blessing in disguise, because the best way to learn is by doing, right? And so my first job out of college, the company pivoted like within 6 months. So what ended up happening was I ended up getting like ownership of an entire vertical for the old product line to sell myself. And I was able to build a team. And that was just based on the unique circumstances of a company and pivot. That, you know, one thing led to another. I got noticed by a bigger company, went and led a team there. I was like 25 years old leading teams. And then that led me to Nextcaller, where I was for about 8 years and was able to get a leadership sales role for a YC company, then start selling enterprise deals, multi-million dollar contracts, you know, like in my late 20s. Again, so just like had these opportunities to do these things. And I made a ton of mistakes. I'm not going to say, I don't want to sit here and make it sound like I'm bragging to everybody about all these opportunities I got. I made a ton of mistakes just because I was thrust into these roles. But to come full circle on the question, what I found is that I never actually really had any formal sales training. I did a little bit of sales training in my second company, and they trained me a little bit in the first one about how to, you know, do certain things, but not, I never really went through like the Sandler training or any like really, you know, formal program. And a lot of what was allowing me to be successful were these great relationships that I built with people. And it's just something inherent that I have, where I have a desire to actually help people. And it just comes through in the way that I sell and actually do a lot of things that are counterintuitive. And you know, this has changed over time, you know, because when I first started selling, I thought that it was all about me and, you know, being charismatic. And I learned later on that it was all about the customer and, you know, how to ask good questions and things like that. But the main tenet that never changed was that I was behaving in an authentic way. I wasn't putting on a different hat at work than I was at home. And I truly looked at the customer as someone that I really wanted to help. In fact, I would probably get more anxiety about an angry customer than no customer. So that's something that I especially in the wake of all of this like machine learning and AI stuff that's going on lately, I thought to myself, you know, that it's going to be more important than ever for salespeople to embrace what makes them human, which is their authenticity, what makes them unique, because you're already starting to see AI creep into the sales world. And, you know, there's a lot of technology now that automates functions that salespeople used to do. So I think it's fairly naive for the sales community to think that they're somehow exempt from this wave of AI and machine learning, just because it's happening to, you know, truck drivers and people at the CVS checkout, doesn't mean that it's not going to happen to you as well. So that's what really got me interested in this concept. It was a combination of, I think, knowing that it was something that worked for me as somebody who wasn't overly or rigorously trained, but also seeing the trends in our industry and just in the world at large, that this is a philosophy that is probably going to gain traction as time goes on.
There's so much to unpack out of that, because I think there are a lot of folks that are, oh, why have you been so good at sales? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I've like shown up and just kind of been me, and like, I want to help. And I think when you can get to that part of like, I want to show up and actually help others bring value and realize it's about the customer and not just about me and my paycheck every month, becomes such a more fulfilling purpose to pursue beyond just, oh yeah, I need to, you know, hit 200% the quota because I want to hit 200% the quota. It's like, well, if I can do that because I'm helping other people do something, solve a problem, help them do their job better, we can start to actually find more sustainable success in our lives, opposed to knowing that I'm just showing up for that grind. I'm curious, you touched on a vein that I'd love to unpack a little bit around this AI-driven world, you know, technology going to you know, product-led growth, all these things where the role of the seller is really shifting and evolving, I think, in some ways. And so what are you seeing, you know, organizations or teams doing the best to help support sellers as we move to this newer world of how we sell and how we can interact, especially in tech?
Yeah, it's a great question. You need to be smarter than the customer at the end of the day. You need to be an industry expert. And I think that's what made me pretty strong when I was at Nextcaller, because, you know, the way of information gathering has changed significantly. The sales rep used to be responsible for telling you about the product and, you know, how it works and things like that, because the information wasn't readily available on the internet. Today, that's really changed. And even the way that people run a sales process has evolved. There's a lot more thoughtful discovery. It's, you know, you have to assemble key stakeholders, because a lot of the interrogation is actually going the other way now. The salespeople are asking the customer, are you qualified to buy for me? And, you know, are we the best option for you? You know, these companies can go online. If they wanted to do an RFP, they could conceivably go online and gather all of the information. They could get a sales rep to figure out if they're meeting the requirements or not. But that, at the end of the day, if that's all you're doing, you're really just an order taker, right? Like, you're just kind of answering questions, and anyone can do that role. To my point about this whole thing with authenticity and about being better than the machines, like, you also want to be better than your fellow man or woman who could take your job too, right? And so you can't just be an order taker. You can't just be knowledgeable about your product. You need to understand the industry at large. And something that I say in my book is that you need to sell a vision that goes beyond the thing that you sell. And I'll talk a little bit about what I mean by that. That whatever it is that you sell isn't a life-changing thing for your customer. It never is. I mean, when I say life-changing, I mean, it could be life-changing, but it won't solve all of their problems in eternity. Customers always going to have new problems. In fact, your solution will help them have different problems than the ones they have today. They'll allow them to focus on other problems, right? At the end of the day, if they don't have problems, their lives aren't really even worth living. Not to be dark, but like, we really lose meaning in our lives unless we have problems to solve. And so understanding that means that there's a temporality behind whatever it is that you sell. It's solving a problem today, but it's not solving every problem. And so if you want to put yourself in your customer's shoes, you need to think about all of the problems that they could conceivably want to solve and advise them about how you can be a part of that, but then help them understand how they can get the rest of it and how you can be a good partner to help them identifying the rest of those things. And I found that when I know a lot about the industry and I can point them to different solutions and I can show them how we fit into this longer term vision, and I'm selling beyond the thing that I'm selling, I'm actually speaking their language as opposed to my language. My language is just focusing on what I have and how it solves this one problem that they have today. Their problem goes well beyond whatever I'm giving them today. And so if you're an industry expert, you understand everything about any problem that they could have, and you show that to them, the customer starts to see you as a consultant that they have in their back pocket and not a salesperson. And they say, if I sign up with this guy or this girl, I'm going to be able to have them on speed dial and they're going to help me through a lot of different things. And so I worked in a really niche industry. It was, you know, the phone fraud and authentication space. I had to understand how, you know, telecom works and a lot of nerdy stuff about, you know, voice recognition and how the network carriers interplay with one another. But when you're able to explain that, you know, the most fine grained detail and explain what the competitor's doing, how the space is evolving and how the fraud is evolving, the customer perceives that you're smarter than them. They start to see you as somebody who can give them a lot of value beyond the product that you sell. So I think companies really need to hone in on that. White papers, regular dedicated time towards becoming industry experts and helping to position their people by doing just even things like this, where they're having conversations that get posted on the internet for other people to see. Those are all best practices that I think I think everybody needs to be thinking about right now.
Yeah, I think there is so much value to your point in learning and developing that set of knowledge to bring your own unique set of wisdom to the world that other folks don't have. I think as sellers, you realize that you have so many more conversations with people in that industry, especially if you're hitting a niche, than even the people that sit in the company, you know, doing the thing, sitting in that main role. It's like you have this perspective that's incredibly valuable from learning the struggles and challenges that other people go through. And you mentioned something in the book about being weird and how that's okay. And I think in so many cases, especially as we look at scaling organizations, like we want everybody to fit in this tight little mold and people are afraid of like being themselves. And so talk to me about the value or power in being weird.
Yeah, so I should add a caveat. You should be weird as long as it's authentically weird, because there's a difference. And I'll give you an example. So you look at someone like Hilaria Baldwin, let's say, who's Alec Baldwin's wife. She pretended that she was Spanish. She's actually not. She's from Boston. So she's like from right down the street from me, but literally, you know, changed her name, pretended to have a Spanish accent, adopted this, you know, exotic, I wouldn't say weird, but, you know, like an exotic culture, something different, right? Which is, I think, we associate with weird. And she's completely rejected because it's not who she truly is, right? And so there's certainly going to be people that want to stand out from the crowd and will take on a persona that's not their own. But the problem is that most people can sniff that out. And if they discover that you're not who they thought you were, it actually makes it infinitely worse than just being who you normally would be. That being said, you look at somebody like Dennis Rodman, who I think is one of the best examples of, I talk about him all the time and I'm not like necessarily a huge fan of his, but he, you know, he was almost as famous as Michael Jordan in the 90s and wasn't even half the basketball player. And that's largely just because of his personality. This is somebody who wore a wedding dress down Fifth Avenue, somebody who took a week off to go party in Vegas during the middle of the season. This is somebody who after a game was in the locker room wearing combat boots on a treadmill, talking shit to Kevin Garnett. This is somebody who even today is best friends with a dictator in North Korea who otherwise wants nothing to do with anybody in our country except Dennis Rodman. And while I would not say that it's smart to befriend foreign dictators, it does say something about his personality that he's deemed trustworthy by this individual. He wants nothing to do with anyone else in our country. And so where I'm going with this is that when people perceive that you are being your authentic self, that you are presenting an honest version of yourself, they trust you. It doesn't mean they like you, but it means they trust you. And trust is really important in sales. You know, think about a time you go to a restaurant and you order something and the waiter says, that's actually really bad. I wouldn't recommend that. I would get this instead. You probably actually take their advice because why else would someone neg their own product, right? If they're going to neg their own product and then tell you what else to get, it means like, hey, this person's probably being honest. It doesn't mean you like the waiter or the waitress. It just means that you trust them. It's no different than if you had a baby and you needed someone to babysit your kid. Would you take the charismatic, you know, salesperson that you like, or would you have your mom babysit your kid? You probably prefer to go to Vegas with the salesperson. You might like them more. They might be more fun to party with, but your mom is the better choice for babysitting because she's more trustworthy in most situations, right? So the weird thing is something that I found to be effective when I'm doing cold outreach. You know, I want to stand out from the crowd and I want to find shared values between me and the other person that I'm contacting. And sometimes that ends up being something that's a little bit strange. You know, the best example that I've given is I once booked a meeting with American Airlines with a subject line, American Airlines tweets with my cat, because about a decade ago, I had created a Twitter account for my cat. And we had this viral exchange with American Airlines on Twitter. And it resulted in Fancy Feast, you know, caught wind of it and sent us a bunch of free cat food. It was like this whole to-do. And so I wrote them an email about it. But like, you know, it actually was relevant to why I was reaching out. It had to do with their customer service and their customer experience. But it's that type of thing that, and it was obviously a real authentic experience. I wasn't making it up, and it's something they could look up on their end to verify. So that's the type of thing that I think really works. Unfortunately, a lot of what people are taught today is to do something that's very formulaic and canned, usually has bullet points and hyperlinks. And the thing is that most people, that because they get so many of those, because it's not weird, they see it and they say sales email and they delete it. And so the weird thing works as long as it's authentic and real. I've had reps who have unfortunately learned this lesson the wrong way, I think, from me, and maybe tried to spin yarns and maybe stretch the truth, and they've been exposed for it and they've been scolded by me. So don't lie to people. Be authentically different, be authentically weird. And what I have found is that it will, if it does not get people to like you, it will certainly get them to trust you.
Wow. Yeah. Trust is just such a powerful, I talk to folks all the time. I'm like, trust is the currency of today's day and age. It's, if you're not trustworthy, people can throw you out as quickly as they want. And why would you not want to be somebody who's trustworthy? Like I just, for me, at least in my personal value system, but I'd be curious, like what do most leaders screw up about building authenticity with themselves? We've heard a lot about how reps can work. Like where have you seen different leaders that you've worked with, or as you've moved through your own leadership journey, you know, leading sales organizations, how have you seen folks screw that up along the way?
Yeah. By not doing and by telling people what to do, or by not being vulnerable. So, you know, I've had great leaders in my life, and, you know, I think about the good ones versus the bad ones. No one wants to work for somebody who tells people what to do, won't do it themselves, and positions themselves as somebody who is infallible, right? If I were talking to my team, talking about, hey, you know, you grunts need to do all this work, and I know it'll work because it worked for me, and I make, you know, these massive W-2s, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't resonate. In fact, I'm not going to name names, but there's somebody in my LinkedIn sphere who's like a sales thought leader who's constantly touting multi-million dollar W-2s and trying to get people to sign up for his like program to learn about how he does it. I don't want to do it because my perception is that the guy is arrogant. You know, I don't feel that they are like me. However, the message was about how this person had failed for a decade and how the failure had led him to this great success, I would start to resonate with that. Not because I see myself as a failure, but because I would feel that that person's more relatable to me because I have flaws and I've made a lot of mistakes. And so when you're teaching people how to do things, it's actually a lot easier and much easier to build trust if you're talking about the failure you had that got you to do it and telling people that you don't want them to make the same mistake as you, because now you're not bragging to them. You're actually kind of doing them a favor and saying, hey, I walked down this path. It didn't work for me. And I'd hate for you guys to walk down that path. I sure wish I had someone to tell me which path to walk down, right? And so now they see you as somebody who's honest, someone who's vulnerable. I've told people about in some of my meetings, I quit the wrestling team in college and like multiple times. And how I think about that every single day, like I gave up on that. And that's like a story that I hope helps people see that I fall short of the mark too, and that I hold, you know, I hold grudges against myself. I beat myself up just like they do. So I think it's really important for leaders not to think of themselves as these people who have to be perfect and to show themselves being perfect to their team. Quite the opposite. The more fallible you are, the more relatable, and the more when you're telling people to do things, they will see you not as someone who's an arrogant bully, but somebody who has walked that path and wants the best for them because you're just like them.
The power of vulnerability. I just love that. And I find that a lot of people are terrified to express, you know, the areas where they've screwed up, to realize though that your leader is not perfect, that we're human. Mm-hmm. We all have flaws. We have regrets, and that's okay. But it's about what do we do from that and how do we move from there? And I think you had an interesting post on your blog doing, you know, some of your like year in review. And I'm a huge fan of that process of being able to say, hey, here's what went well for me. Here's where I'd like to improve. Here's where I'd like to go. And I'd love to learn a little bit about how you think about, you know, okay, how do I wrap up a year? You know, what do I look at? What's your process? Do you have a system that you use? Talk to folks about how you kind of look at, you know, what you've done in the past, and then how do you learn about how you move forward from there?
Yeah. So I think that there's maybe two different ways that you want to look at that. One is within the confines of your professional goals, and one is within the confines of your personal goals. So on the professional level is much easier because professional is a piece of the much bigger picture, which is your personal goals in your life. So the professional goals in selling, you know, it's honestly kind of a boring answer. I look at, you know, the numbers, and I try to use the numbers to figure out what we did well and why, and where things didn't work out and why. And then I try to work with my team. Usually like the last couple of weeks of the year are very slow for me in the industries I've worked in. And so it's like a really good time for me to like get with my team and look at some of this stuff together and use it as like brainstorming time for holistic strategic changes for the following year, because I'm not really doing anything else. It's the holidays and people are kind of checked out. So that's usually what I'm doing professionally. But personally, I talk a lot, especially with people that I mentor, about understanding your why. Because, and when I say like, what's your why? I'm like, what is it that you really want to accomplish in your life? So an example of a bad answer would be to say like, I just want to make a lot of money, because in that scenario, you haven't peeled the onion far enough to figure out what you really want, because the money itself isn't inherently valuable to you. Like sitting in your room, the paper doesn't do anything for you, but maybe the thought that it exists allows you to take a certain risk that you'd like to do, or it allows you to do some good for the world or some mission that you want to fulfill. And if you don't have a why, you're kind of running in the hamster wheel. And what I mean by that is like, you're kind of just continuously working, but you don't really know what you're working for. And if you do have a why, you're kind of anchoring yourself to something with a specific time frame. So for example, if I said, you know, my goal is to be a millionaire by the age of 30, you know, then there's probably certain milestones I need to hit at 25, 26, 27, you know, 28 and 29, right? And you can start to break down micro goals. And then if you're not like achieving those, like in the same way that you do like an annual review professionally, you can do it for yourself personally to figure out how to get yourself back on track. But if you don't have a goal that you're working for within a specific time frame, then that all becomes nebulous, right? Like if I just want to be a millionaire at any point in my life, then I'm not really going to hold myself accountable because I have until I'm dead to accomplish it, right? So I find like, you know, you need to understand your why. And then at the end of every year, you need to ask yourself, like, did I achieve the milestones that I wanted to achieve towards obtaining that? So that's the way that I think about it. Similar process, but one is a lot more important than the other.
Yeah. And the power of understanding your why, how'd you get there? Like what I find for folks, they, I might ask them like what their purpose is. And they say, I don't know. I've hit my quota or like get my team to their number or whatever it is. How did you get to that deeper why, or how do you help folks think about that?
Yeah. So it's funny because I literally just like did this exercise with a new group of four mentees last week. And they all had a good understanding, I think, of like where they were, but they all needed like one or two nudges from me to get there. And you know, the answer is boring. You need to keep asking yourself why until you get to the answer. And so for a lot of people, like you'll know, for a lot of people, it's like evident that they're not there yet. So like I had, you know, a mentee who said they wanted to be able to have some stability and like provide for their family and make their own choices about life or whatever. And I said, that's cool. But like, I think everybody wants that, right? Like, why? Like, why do you care about that? And, you know, he didn't know. And I said like, well, you know, it sounds like stability really matters to you. Like, what was your childhood like? The person told me they moved 13 times as a child. And I said, how did you feel about that? He said, it was stressful. I said, was it your choice? He said, no. I said, like, do you know what your why is now? And I'm like, yeah, I want to be able to call my own shots because I never got to do it growing up. Right. I want to have the stability. Like that's why he wants the stability, right? Because he likes being in control. So it's so like, you need to ask yourself like why it is even that you want the thing that you want. And so for me, like I ultimately want to be a screenwriter. You know, sales is a way for me to hopefully gain some financial independence that allow me to do that. But the thing with screenwriting is it's not even inherently that I like writing or anything like that. It's more when I really peel the onion, I found that especially having gone to a school, the motto was from those to whom much has been given, much will be expected. I feel as like a relatively privileged person, a duty to give back to others. But I've also found that I actually just feel better when I do that. I enjoy the impact that I can make by doing something for someone else. And I think I have a good gift in my ability to write. And if I can move people through that medium, then that's like a great like winning ticket for me. So for me, it's about the feeling I get when I do something positive for others. And if I can manifest that through writing, but you have to come a long way from sales and money and stuff like that to get to that answer. You literally have to ask the question five times to get there. So it's a deliberate process. Usually best done with a friend, somebody that you trust with, you know, things about you that are personal, and somebody that will push you because you can't settle for something that's above, you got to go below the surface to get to the, like a really sound answer. If you give an answer that you think a lot of other people would give, you're probably not there yet. You need to get to something that's fairly unique to you.
And back into that thought of like being uniquely you and your weird self. That's like, yeah, hey, here's my unique blend of knowledge, perspective, hopes, dreams, passions, love areas, and hobbies that allow you to like bring that together to be yourself. And I love that thought of if you give an answer that a bunch of other people would give, you're probably not there yet. It is really interesting. And I'm curious then, because I saw you had, you know, degree in writing, creative writing, I think from Princeton, and then ended up in sales, which like doesn't totally align. So I guess I will ask the standard, like, well, how'd you end up in sales then?
Yeah, kind of fell into it, to be honest. I lacked a lot of intentionality when I was younger, be perfectly blunt. I was a smart guy, but I was very naive about a lot of things and didn't really, even thinking about college, a lot of my classmates were very deliberate from the time they got there. They knew that they needed, you know, certain classes, that they wanted to get into a certain field. And, you know, for me, I wasn't even thinking about that. I was like very much all over the place. And I ended up pivoting from economics into English. And like you said, creative writing. And, you know, I was showing up to these interviews for like finance and consulting jobs and stuff and just getting smoked in these interviews. You know, they were asking me these questions like, you know, how many pennies do you think there are in a mall, and how would you like go about, you know, finding the answer? And like, I'd been reading Shakespeare for years, you know, so like I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I had a bunch of opportunities. Fortunately, I had some offers to work in sports. I had some offers for, you know, teaching roles. And then I ultimately came across this sales role for a tech startup in Boston. The founder had dropped out of Princeton, ironically. And what really caught my attention about it was that it said that you will like, I don't think it said this verbatim, but it's like you basically write your own paycheck. Like the harder you work, the more money you make. And that really resonated with me, because there's one thing that I knew about myself, for all my flaws and for all of my inability to focus and be intentional, is that whenever there was something that I put my mind to, I would outwork anyone to get it. Like I'm incredibly competitive. I hate losing. Even when I do like a workout class, like with strangers, whoever's next to me hates me because I'm just trying to be like better than them, right? Like that's just how I'm wired. And so when I saw that that was the role, it's like, hey, if you work really hard, you'll make a lot of money. I was like, okay, that sounds exciting to me. I like it because it's up to me entirely. You know, I'm someone who I like wrestling, which is like, you know, a sport that's kind of just up to you. I like having the ball in my hands. It's not that I'm not I like working with teams, of course. I think that's what makes your job fun. But I like when my efforts are directly tied to my compensation and that I have a direct ability to make like a really big impact on a company. I want to feel that my work matters. So I applied for that job and, you know, worked out great. I worked there for 2.5 years. Company ended up getting acquired by Grubhub for like $400 million. That was after I left. So I'm not going to take credit for that, but it was still, you know, awesome experience for me and awesome to be, you know, working for a company that had a successful exit.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful and a cool story, because I think so many of us just kind of stumble in towards the sales realm. But then again, I love this thought of like, how do you be weird? How do you lean into your own background and skills that most other people don't have? You know, I bet there's probably not a ton of sales leaders that have read a lot of Shakespeare in their life. And now all of a sudden you've got a little bit of a different perspective you can bring to the world that, again, makes you uniquely you and allows you to stand out is really interesting. I'm curious. I saw you spend some time within the Red Sox organization, field crew, you know, assistant I think it was Larry. What did you learn while watching that level of professionalism? I'm a big fan of sports and taking lessons from sports into sales and leadership. I'm curious if anything stands out from your time watching the Red Sox operate that you learn or bring in today.
Yeah, it's actually probably one of the reasons I work in sales, because I think otherwise I would have worked in sports. And that's going to sound like an indictment on sports or the Red Sox, but it really shouldn't be. I had two different jobs when I worked there. One was working on the grounds crew, which was in like high school and college. And I had a summer internship in college working for Larry Lucchino, who's the CEO. Nice. And that was like a front office role. These are two very different roles. You know, one is like kind of like a blue collar role. One was more of like a white collar role. The grounds crew job was very physically demanding. I'd be there really early every day. People think that these are good, just people that work on the field in the middle of the game or like for a rain delay, but it's actually like a full day. You get there like 6 or 7 a.m.
Yep.
You have to clean up the field, trim the grass, clean the dugouts. You know, cleaning the dugouts, those baseball players are very dirty. You know, each one probably took me like an hour to clean and hose down and make it look nice for the next day. So I really learned the value of hard work there. You know, I was like an upper middle class kid. I went to like one of the best high schools in the United States. My parents paid for my high school education, private high school and for Princeton. So I'm definitely, you know, I don't shy away from this, but I was given a lot of opportunity. This was a role that was like really physically challenging and demanding. And I made like $7 an hour, like minimum wage at the time. So I really appreciated the value of money. And I really learned that even things that seem really cool at the end of the day are just jobs, right? And so I learned a lot about that. The front office job was pretty cool because I got a look at the other side of things. I got to see like, you know, what the CEO does every day. I had correspondence with other executives. I was writing letters for this guy, like to Nolan Ryan and other, you know, executives in the league and stuff like that. But the other thing I saw about it is that, you know, I know, and this is specific to the Red Sox, but I think that a lot of companies in sports have a feeling that there's so many people who want those jobs that there's not necessarily a need to provide a ton of perks, compensation, upward mobility, et cetera, you know, because the feeling is that if you just work at the company that you're probably pretty pumped just to have tickets to go to the game or whatever. And, you know, I loved baseball as a kid, but, you know, I didn't, not that I anticipated that my interest would change. It did, but it's not a reason in and of itself that you get like to go to watch baseball games, to me at least, that you should, you know, make that leap. For some people it is, because it's a passion for them forever. But for me, it was actually a deterrent and showed me that maybe there was another path that I could have taken. And I had an offer to work for the Pittsburgh Pirates out of college. I'd probably say the number one reason I didn't do that, was because I had learned that, you know, there were probably some other things that were more viable, for me.
It's so great. I love talking with folks about life's kind of like bumper cars. It's like you go in a direction, you hit a wall, and then you turn and you figure out where you want to go. But we learn so much better by doing, by taking action, by trying different things. And so I think there's so much to that of like, yeah, you got in there and you got to live and learn and see how they operate. What do they think about? How do they, you know, perceive the role and the people that work for them and say like, oh yeah, maybe that's not exactly where I want to be. You go try something new and hey, look at that. It's stuck and gives you learning, but you've still got this wisdom now to say, oh, well, down the road, like here's still where I know I want to go be a screenwriter. And again, take this unique experience where there's probably not a lot of people into screenwriting that have had like a sales and tech sales background and watch tech companies grow. And so there's some really cool stuff there. I love this. So a couple kind of rapid fire questions for you as we round things out here, Jeff. Talk to me a little bit about how do you support your mental health, your well-being, and your mindset?
Yeah. So I'd say there's a few things that are important to me. I've been talking to therapists for a long time, like even since I was like a teenager. I had some traumatic things happen to me in high school. I had a friend pass away. I had like a really bad car accident. So I started doing that like even before it became more, maybe I should say like less stigmatized to do that. And meditation is something that I've gotten into. And I'm very active, which I found just helps me a lot with like anxiety and work-life balance. Like if I don't do a lot of moving around, I just don't feel good. Whereas if I do, I feel more energized. I feel better about myself, which is important. You need to have good feelings towards you. It's probably one of the most important things is to, you know, have little accomplishments that you can point to for yourself. So I'd say like, it's important for people to carve out time to make sure that they're doing the things that matter to them. Especially now, like we work in a world now where working remote is not taboo anymore. And, you know, if you wanted to conceivably go to a different place just to like clear your mind, you could do that. And, you know, it's interesting, like when the pandemic started in March of, I guess, 2020, I was living in New York City and I ended up temporarily going to my parents' house in Cape Cod. And I actually ended up staying there for a while. Didn't realize what was going on, but just, you know, people were asking me like, oh, I'm sure it must have been sad to like be there over the winter. There's probably like nothing going on. And I think what I said surprised them. I said I actually liked it more in the winter than in the summertime when it was really popular. It's It's very peaceful, you know, going for a run, getting outside, just seeing the, like being in nature, not being in the hustle and bustle of New York was actually kind of like a welcome, you know, distraction. I mean, I don't want to paint it the wrong way. Obviously what was going on in the world was not great, but it made what was otherwise a very stressful time a little less stressful to get away from some of the normal stimulus that I was accustomed to. And so sometimes it's just like a simple change of scenery, and forcing yourself to deal with a change of scenery. I think a lot of times when people get stressed, they're really tricking themselves. The reality is the stress is that it's like they have the same mundane stuff to do every single day. So it feels very stressful to them. But even if you just take a trip somewhere, work remote for a week, those same people, they have the same responsibilities, might feel a lot different, their attitude towards those responsibilities because of just their physical presence. So, you know, there's like a few things that I think are pretty easy to do. There's so many different ways now that you can talk to people. There's so many companies now that are investing in this stuff and trying to create these benefits. I always take advantage of any of these things, whether it's like City Bike in New York or like a One Medical membership. Like these things are super clutch to have. So I used to like see these perks and just think they were silly. And now I'm like all over it every time I get an offer to try something new. So
yeah, there's so many good things in there, and just change of scenery. You know, I've seen therapists for many years. I've changed and gone to different ones at different times in my life, but I think there's so much power in having that time to reflect, having that space, investing in yourself by leveraging those benefits or perks. Can I get two more pretty quick questions out of you?
You got it.
All right. So an organization I'm super passionate about when I was in Boston, I know you've been doing work with Big Brothers Big Sisters for a while. What's one thing you've learned from your little in your time working with them?
I think one thing I've learned from him is how little of my time can make such a big difference to somebody else. I think this is a thing. Yeah. Sorry.
No, go.
I think this is a thing that actually deters people from mentorship. They assume that maybe there's a lot of work involved in order to accomplish some sort of outcome. And the answer is really, if you're in a position of privilege or experience that you can lend to someone else, it's actually very little of your time that you would need to give in order to make a meaningful dent for that individual because of your respective position. And so for example, like, you know, if I take him to like Dave and Buster's, you know, he's thrilled, right? I mean, it's like the Super Bowl for him. For me, it's just like another opportunity to, you know, go out and do something that seems fun, right? Like it doesn't seem like anything to me. It takes a couple hours of my time, a little bit of money, but he's thrilled, right? And it's like, that's true in the other mentorship stuff I've done professionally. Like if I'm able to introduce somebody to someone that I know in my network, that takes me like 2 seconds. Like sometimes I don't even remember that the person was in my network, right? And I just broker the intro. But for this other person, it's a career. Like that's how they got their career started, right? And so that takes what, 10 seconds of my time to do that? Like, I don't think I'm a hero for doing any of these things. To me, it's really very straightforward, but the impact that you can make is immeasurable. So I think that's probably the number one thing I've learned is that you can make a huge dent without having to do too much. I'm not saying that you should be lazy in how you go about trying to make an impact, but if it were to help people to think about more involvement with mentorship, that is the number one thing that I would say.
That's great. It's so powerful. I heard a quote the other day from Warren Sapp, NFL player, talking about, you know, someone was like, why do you sign so many autographs? Why do you like do all this extra stuff when a lot of people don't? And he was like, it's so easy for me to make somebody's day in a matter of seconds.
Yeah,
I'm going to take that time out. And I think we don't have to be NFL players. You don't have to be, you know, somebody that is like a celebrity to really make an impact on lives. And that's something that I love so much about Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And I'm so glad that you pulled that out. One word, maybe, if you can, what does success mean to you today? It's a tough one to get in one word. You can give me a sentence if you want.
I think happiness, you know, because, you know, and I don't want to sound like super existential or anything, but we really don't know what our purpose is here. Some people think they know, right? But there's no hard and fast scientific proof of why we're here and what our purpose is and, you know, what we need to do. And in the absence of that, I would say that if you can live your life being happy, that to the best of our knowledge, that's probably the best way that you can live your life. And so, you know, if you can identify your why and try to fulfill it and see everything as an opportunity, means to an end, towards that end that will bring you that fulfillment and that happiness, that's what I would say is probably what success looks like, because there's no arbitrary, there's no objective standard. Mm-hmm. You know, someone could say Elon Musk is successful. He's successful in the parameters of the way our society is designed. I'm a fan of his, by the way. I'm not like some, you know, anti-capitalist person who hates Elon Musk, but you know, success is very subjective in those terms. So
yeah, that's great. Well, Jeff Kirchick, thank you so much for joining us on the Peak Performance Selling Podcast. We'll definitely link off to your book for folks to check out. I know there's a personal website as well where you got some good blog posts. Where should folks find you? Where's the best place to follow you and connect with you?
Yeah, either on LinkedIn or on jeffkirchick.com.
Awesome. Well, until next time, let's go make today great.
It's thanks to help from listeners like you, this podcast can continue to grow and help others. If you found anything helpful in today's episode, please take a second, share with a friend, and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast today. Thanks.